We're going to open the Joint Legislative Task Force on County Payments. I personally apologize for being a little late. I was getting some things taken care of in a meeting room that had nobody in it. So it was nice to get back over here, and we had a couple of little things we had to take care of. But we appreciate the people being here, and we will get underway. And I thank all of our committee members for being here. And with that, we're going to have an informational meeting, and we're going to invite Gary Blackmer up to give us a little indicators of health in local governments.
Thank you, co-chairs. My name is Gary Blackmer. I'm the Audits Director in the Secretary of State Audits Division. You've asked me to come speak about our financial review of Oregon's counties. And from our standpoint, we see the counties as playing a key role in state government, particularly as an important partner of the state in terms of health, social services, criminal justice. And their financial health is a key part of the state's service delivery and is of prime concern to the state. Especially looking at the difficulties that the counties have faced in terms of tax limitations, transfers of responsibilities from the state, escalating costs, and changes in federal fiscal policy. So that was kind of the start of our audit or our review of financial condition. I should say that I counted up, this is my 12th financial condition report that I've produced in my career. I produced a number of them. I produced the first one in the city of Portland in the late 80s, about four of them in Multnomah County as the county auditor, and then directed about five of them in the city of Portland since then. And they were valuable products in terms of understanding the overall condition of finances in an organization and what are the drivers, what are the early trends that can be a warning that the leadership can look at and take proactive action on. So our objective in this review was to look at the financial condition of the counties, all 36 within Oregon, and identify any kind of general strategies that might be applied for addressing financial concerns that we saw there. And looking specifically at those counties that also receive the federal timber payment funds in order to look, because we saw that as a high stressor for those counties as well. But I want to emphasize that we really did not identify any specific solutions to these counties. As auditors, we feel like we can kind of report on conditions, but actually being able to get into individual counties and make recommendations about taxes or services is really best done at a local level. So we tried to understand where the counties were, but not necessarily what they needed to do. We looked at the methodologies that other states use to monitor the financial condition of their local governments, and we ultimately concluded that we needed to develop our own indicators. There was no commonly accepted set of indicators. We generally based ours on the set that were developed by the International City and County Managers Association, and we also borrowed a number of the indicators from the State of Oregon financial condition report that we issued last year. So we wanted to make sure that what we had was responsive to the tax structure and service structure of counties here in Oregon. We ended up with 10 indicators, and we used information that the counties had submitted in their annual audited financial statements as the basis for it, for seven of those 10. And we adjusted them so that we could compare across the counties, either on a per capita basis or as a percentage of total spending, so that we could actually look at where the 36 counties lay and compare with each other. The seven financial indicators were what we call local support, which is essentially all of the local revenues that were raised by that county. We were not able to identify something called general fund because the counties treat it so differently in terms of their accounting practices. Some move funds in and out, and it's difficult to get some commonality in terms of what a general fund is. So we use just all the local revenues raised by the counties. Another indicator was timber payment dependence. Another was debt burden, which was essentially the debt payments as a percentage of total spending. Liquidity, which is a representation of the short-term cash position. How much in short-term obligations do they have versus ready cash. Fund balance, which was a snapshot of how much money was in the fund on June 30th, which doesn't necessarily mean it can be spent without being an, it is encumbered in some way because it's part of their cash management until their property taxes come in November. So you can't necessarily say, well, that's unencumbered money that can be spent for any purpose. Retirement benefit obligation, which is essentially their unfunded liability. In most cases, it's PERS. And then public safety spending, which encompasses sheriff, jails, prosecution, and their other criminal justice responsibilities. We also had three indicators of demographic or economic type indicators like per capita income, population trends, and unemployment. So what we found was that these indicators, a number of counties showed up as having a number of negative indicators, and we focused in on those counties and gathered more information. There were eight counties that we felt needed monitoring in more detail: Coos, Curry, Douglas, Jackson, Josephine, Klamath, Lane, and Polk. And for these counties, we went back 8 years in terms of their
Could you read those?
Oh, sorry.
One more time.
Oh, sure. Coos, Curry, Douglas, Jackson, Josephine, Klamath, Lane, and Polk. And what we did was we went back 8 more years for those 8 counties to see, was it a trend that was improving or a trend that was worsening, and being able to kind of put more context around it. And then we also contacted the finance officers of each of those counties to find out what kind of activities they were undertaking in order to address their financial issues. So that was essentially how we put together our report to kind of describe current conditions in the counties. And we ended up using the counties to compare among themselves. So our audit is on our website if you'd like to look at it. But essentially, what we had for an indicator was all 36 counties. And you can see that there was quite a range in terms of each of these indicators for each county. And so the counties that came up, for example, Yamhill spending $150 per capita on public safety versus Sherman County spending over $1,000 per capita on public safety. Those were things that gave us some sense of kind of a critical service that the county needed to provide. And using that was how we came down to those 8. If they showed up in kind of the negative side of those indicators a number of times. And we actually put a little extra emphasis on the timber funds because those were obviously discretionary dollars that were going away, and it would put an added stressor which might not be there for other kinds of indicators. So the last thing we did, though, was we looked at what other states had been doing in terms of monitoring and kind of advising and intervening even in local government in terms of financial troubles. Other states have been through these kinds of situations with their governments for in a number of periods of time. And in fact, the ICMA report that I mentioned that we based our work on, the methodology, it actually came out of the financial troubles of the early 80s when a number of cities went bankrupt. And what they saw in their financial reports was clear indications that trouble was ahead, but no one was tuned into it. So they developed this indicator system in order to help spot that. So they looked at 10-year trends as a means of identifying risks out there that might not be seen because they tend to creep up on organizations. So what we found was that some states...
Oh. Yeah, do you want a question now?
Yes, sir.
Please.
You mentioned the audit on the website, and I'm having a hard time finding it. What's the number?
Oh, I'm sorry. The number is 2012-17. And if you go to the front page of our audits, it's under the performance audits, maybe a third of the way down.
Got it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
What we found was some states monitor the financial condition of some of their governments. Other states actually go beyond that, and they have some kind of proactive committees that go out and provide advice to governments if they're having difficulty. Some states have gotten to the point, a few of them, where they can actually have, they're empowered, they've empowered an officer to go out on behalf of the state to work with that jurisdiction to solve problems. Most recently, I think you maybe have seen in the news, the state of Michigan has sent out folks to work with cities that are having financial trouble. It's a it's not a very pleasant thing for anyone to go through, whether it's the monitor stepping into the city council who has to give up some of their autonomy, or the citizens who feel like the state has stepped in and taken over the responsibilities that they've empowered in their representatives. So there are not a lot of pleasant solutions at the uncomfortable end of the spectrum in terms of intervention. When we looked at what Oregon had in terms of its laws, it had very few until the 2012 session, which enacted House Bills 4175, 4176, and 4177. In terms of kind of monitoring and engagement of the counties. So we see that as a good sign, and we have an extensive section to the report at the end that identifies the statutes that the other states have enacted with some brief narrative. So in terms of any kind of model legislation out there that Oregon might consider, we think that could be useful for you folks to look at in terms of any kind of actions that the state might take. I guess what we wanted to do with this report was get a snapshot of the counties right now. We intend to come back in 2 years and do a similar exercise to see what has changed, and be able to kind of see those that are able to deal with the issues that are before them, close the gap that they're going to be losing in terms of timber funds, and be able to move forward versus those that aren't. I think it's going to be a difficult decision on where the state draws a line on where it believes that the counties can recover from the loss of revenues, and those that are going to take more serious action to deal with it. I noted that Jackson County was on that list. In some ways, I think Jackson County is worth looking at and monitoring because they have done a number of things to close the gap. And they have done a number of restructurings of their services and their revenues that I think has helped them get closer to closing that gap. So it might be worth looking at what they have accomplished. They started in the same place as many of the other counties, but I think they've been more proactive than other counties in dealing with it. So to that extent, that's as much as I have here. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So any questions from any of the members of the committee? I see none. I thank you very much, and I will spend some time looking at your report.
I have one question.
I do. What was the other county? Yamhill was $50. The other one was $1,000.
Sherman County.
In public. Sherman.
Mm-hmm.
And can you elaborate just a little bit on that? What were you looking at on the expenses? I mean, was that apples and apples that you were comparing?
Co-Chair Roblin, Co-Chair Verger, yes, we were actually using their financial statements that are prepared according to government audit standards and generally accepted accounting practices, and the categories of public safety are the same in those cases. Sherman County happens to be one of the more wealthy counties, actually, in Oregon. So I think they were able to afford a higher level of public safety than the other counties were.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You indicated that the counties keep their books in a whole different variety of ways. That reminds me of school districts until 7 or 8 years ago. Would it be of benefit, and would it be enough of benefit for the hassle that it causes to require a set of accounts that allow you to compare across counties?
Co-Chair Roblin, Representative Barnhart, it could be useful. This actually came up. I made a presentation to the Oregon Society of CPAs, and several of the accounting firms or auditing firms expressed an interest in having a single chart of accounts. Oregon Department of Education developed one for the school districts. Our hope was that these are simple enough and universal enough that they would still be meaningful, because while we don't necessarily know what the general fund is, we know what the local revenue effort is, and we can kind of work around it in many cases and get to the same point. So I guess if we get into an individual county and try and understand how it manages its funds and how it moves them in and out of various the money through various funds, we need to learn that, but each one is very different, so it would take a lot of work on the county side, and we might lose comparability also from year to year. So at this point, I think it would probably be best to hold off.
Or historical comparability, if I may just
follow up.
As we move more toward transparency in government, one of the values of that school chart of accounts is that somebody who can actually understand it, which is still a challenge, can figure out how to compare one district to another by going to the chart of accounts on the state website. It's simply a thought that part of what we're trying to get done in government is to make it easier for citizens to understand what we're doing and how we compare with each other. So that was part of the reason why I raised the issue, in addition to whether or not it makes it easier to do an audit.
Co-Chair Roblin, Representative Barnhart, I agree with you. I think there are many places where we could be more consistent in our accounting practices so that it could be more transparent. And being able to visually depict how the counties compare, I mean, it took a considerable amount of work on our part to pull all these numbers from the financial statements the first time, but we can do it easier the second time, and certainly there's a lot of automated tools out there that it would be really easy to have the software where people could do queries and the charts show up. In fact, there's one state, I don't recall if it was South Carolina, where they partnered with a university, and you can actually do queries of financial condition of all the local governments on their website. So it's pretty impressive what some states have done.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Chair. I would suggest, and Senator Verger's question about the public safety, and we assume we're comparing apples to apples, we're not. And because I would suggest the difference between Yamhill and Sherman counties, you need to also factor in the amount of acres per capita that are involved in, and to try to get 24/7 coverage. So it's not apples to apples. And so if you're just doing that, you're not really giving a true picture of the need. It's not that Sherman is a richer county. It's the fact that they have a lot of acreage to cover, a lot of miles to cover, very sparse population, and so it by nature is going to cost them more for public safety than it would a more condensed county with a higher population. So we need to be very careful when we just look at numbers and assume that tells us everything, because there's other factors.
Co-Chair Roblin, Senator Cruz, I entirely agree. The level of service and the need for service is a whole other dimension. This is more around where the resources are going, not necessarily what they need in order to provide an adequate level of services.
Okay. I just want to make sure that we're looking at the whole picture and don't get trapped in the numbers.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Which is what he did.
Our next informational meeting is going to be the federal legislation and the county's response to partial extension. So if Simon Hare from Josephine County and Fred Mesley from Coos County and Doug Robertson from Douglas County could come on up. Doug is also the president of the Association of ONC Counties. We also have three other county commissioners here, so and they can stand so we know who they are. If someone has a question for one of these other counties, we can maybe call them up. But Craig Pope from Polk County is here. Thank you, Craig, for being here. Bob Main from Coos County, and John Rasher from Jackson County, who we heard nice statements about the county. So, So thank you. With that, I will let you guys decide how you want to go forward. So, thank you.
I think I'm first on the list. My name is Simon Hare. I'm a commissioner from Josephine County. It's a pleasure to be here, and appreciate you guys taking the time to address issues of major concern to not just Josephine County, but others across the state. And look forward to really, it's going to take a partnership between the state and the counties to solve these challenges, but I don't think they're out of the possibility for a solution. To give some context about where Josephine County is, you probably have heard, and I've testified before for this committee, this joint task force, but just to give you some context, the reduction in staff that Josephine County has taken since I took office in the beginning of 2011 is from 446 full-time equivalents down to 288 in 2012 for that fiscal year. Majority of that is in the criminal justice system, which encompasses the district attorney, the juvenile justice, the jail, and rural patrols. Our adopted budget of going back was $100 to $110 million, and this last year was $68 million. The local property tax revenue that we generate is roughly $3.6 million based on 58 cents per thousand of assessed value. And that's the lowest in the state. Most drastic reduction, obviously, was in the criminal justice system. And to give you an idea, historically, we had 20 hours of rural patrol 7 days a week. And we are down now to 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. It's typically Tuesday through Saturday, which is the highest portion of crime, and only responding to emergency types of things.
I'll stop you for a second. Sir. Senator Johnson.
Have you been tracking the concomitant effect on rate of crime or severity of crime? Because I'm sure you're testifying here in public, and you've probably held public meetings at home, and the bad guys are listening. Are you tracking that?
They were. We had a levy on the ballot in May, and probably the highest round of applause was out of the jail. It's tough to track when we have fewer people in our sheriff's office. There's virtually few people taking calls that are non-emergency based. Everything still goes into our 911 system and is referred to either OSP, but it's kind of, we're trying to keep track of those, but there's an online system now for filing any kind of a burglary, for instance, and you issue almost a self-report, which some insurance companies are not taking as a legitimate because it wasn't followed up on by either a sheriff's deputy or someone. There really isn't an accurate report, so it's tough to follow. We're doing our best, though. I think anecdotally you could say that there is an increase in crime, maybe not violent crime, but certainly thefts and burglaries have definitely been on the rise. So if I could continue.
Yep, please.
Our jail bed capacity was roughly about 130 local jail beds. Now we're down to 30 local inmates that are just Measure 11 offenders. So there's no ramifications for parole violations. Typical DUIs or domestic violence crimes are not housed in our jail unless they're going to be prosecuted by the DA under Measure 11. No shows at trial. I'd say that just the general is 8 out of 10 those that go to trial are no-shows, and there's very few, if any, ramifications. Our estimation is somewhere around $800 per case that doesn't show up. So there's a significant cost to this system that's not working well. Our district attorney's office has gone from 9 DAs down to 5. Like I said, only prosecuting the most severe crimes. Our juvenile detention center and shelter has been closed. We are currently renting 3 beds from Jackson County, and we appreciate their partnership in helping to look out after our most vulnerable juveniles. Our local 4-year local option tax that we put on the ballot in May failed. It was $1.99 per thousand of assessed value, and it failed 43 to 57%, which was actually fairly close for historical levies in Josephine County. It was pretty close, and like I said, our current tax rate is 58 cents a thousand, so it was a significant jump up. People, I think, recognize the severity of what we were looking at, but one of the detractors, I think, that people thought was, well, the feds always come through. You will find the money, and one way or another, this Secure Rural Schools legislation actually kind of validated that and probably hinders our ability to self-finance this criminal justice system in the future. So going into that, our historic payments from the Secure Rural Schools has been $12 to $14 million a year. This allocation was $4.665 million of general funds. Of course, there's Title III and Title II in that, but that's the discretionary portion of our budget. We took $3.95 million and set it aside for fiscal year 13-14 to maintain this current level of criminal justice. If we didn't do that, we'd see another 50 to 60% reduction in what we have right now. And what that means is that we probably wouldn't have more than just one or two DAs. Our jail would be closed and a number of other things. We'd, of course, provide, I guess, that state mandate of one jail bed, but that would be pretty much it. Left up to the board was about $700,000, and we did borrow $425,000 from our road fund this year for rural patrols. So it's a consideration that we would pay that fund back. We did it as a loan. We also have the option of increasing jail beds to 69, adding 39 jail beds with some of these, some of the $700,000, and increasing court security. I want to leave you with just a couple of my suggestions as far as things that I think the state can do to partner with the counties and in moving forward. The previous speaker said something about serious action is probably inevitable, and I think that's absolutely the case. This is a crisis situation. We just got out of a meeting with the governor, and my message is that at the end of fiscal year 13-14, Josephine County is no longer able to meet the basic requirements for criminal justice, and that may be up for debate even right now. So I think support from this body for revenue-generating federal forest management legislation is absolutely key. We're going to need a portfolio of solutions, and this one has to be a major portion of that. There's a designation for critical habitat study area for the northern spotted owl, and I think that needs to be looked at and what the detriment economically could be by that. But that's federal legislation. For us in Josephine County, we spend about $1 million a year on our district attorney's office enforcing state law, and that's a real challenge for us. And like I said, it's going to take a portfolio, and that would be $1 million that we wouldn't have to be allocating as portion of our criminal justice system. And the tax and assessment legislation that was proposed in 2009 to share that burden of the tax and assessment and collections among the different districts. Like I said, we collect 58 cents per thousand, and that's sometimes in other counties could probably be construed as an administrative fee for doing that process. And finally, we have a small thing in Josephine County. We have a state park that has not renewed its long-term lease with the BLM. It's the Fork State Park, and that may not be a revenue generator for a really hard-hit portion of the county, but it gets people off the road, and they stay and buy lunch or what have you. So any kind of encouragement you could give to ORPD, we'd certainly appreciate that. So with nothing further, I just appreciate the opportunity to come and personally convey the message of what's going on in my county. But it's not that much different than either what's going to happen to even strong counties like Jackson County in the future or others. So
what's the name of the state park again?
Illinois Valley River Fork State Park.
Fork State Park, yeah. Okay.
Fork State Park, that's what people
that will work too. And thank you for your thoughtful consideration and the information. We really appreciate it. It's been good to have you here before. It is not a heartening report, but it is a clear picture of what's out there, and I appreciate that very much.
There are positive things that are going on in Josephine County, and we've made incredible strides, I think, over the years prior to do things as efficiently as possible, which is reinforced by our A-plus rating that we just recently got established. And we did refinance our PERS unfunded liability to save about $1 million, $100,000 a year. So those are some things that are examples of positive things that we are doing. So,
thank you. Any questions? Yes. Senator Berger.
Thank you very much. I want to give you a multiple choice. 57% voted against you in the election. So was it because you had the road fund money, or was it because they didn't want to pay for it, or was it because they didn't believe that the county was in crisis?
I'm going to take another one. And the fiscal capacity to pay in Josephine County is definitely a huge factor. We have probably 12% unemployment, but the realistic number is probably closer to 20. So that has that was a huge factor. The federal money that has historically come to bail the counties out was a huge factor. We had an election in 2009 that also failed because the legislation was reauthorized in 2008 for that. So I'd have to say that it's a number of different factors. I don't believe the road funds actually factored in. Most people were probably not aware of that as being an option. Plus, Josephine County doesn't appreciate some of the other reserves that other counties have. We have about $3.2 million in our reserves, and we just use a small portion of that to kind of bridge the gap and provide for some rural patrols. But that's my understanding. I'm recently elected. I've just been here a little while. So having gone through an election, you're kind of tight with the constituents, and that's what I was hearing.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Cruz, Senator Cruz.
I'd like all three of these gentlemen, just for the record, to tell us what percent of their county is owned by the federal government, because it's a huge factor.
True.
And
there's a couple of different statistics that are pretty amazing. The first one is it's about 68% to 70% is owned by the federal. The other one is 7.57% of taxpayers actually pay full assessed value of what their property value is assessed. So there is a huge burden on a very, very small portion of the population. So increasing taxes at all is on a very small population to carry the burden for everyone. So,
you know, Mr. Chair, it's not just the fact that I think in all of these counties, I think the actual unemployment is over 20% in all three counties here. And it's significantly over that. And to be asking these people who are barely able to make mortgage payments to pay more in taxes is totally unreasonable. And the burden is on the federal government to live up to their obligation. I just thought I'd throw that out there.
Yes. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Okay. Excuse me. Co-Chairman Roebling and other members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to give my perspective on what's going on in our corner of rural Oregon. I considered bringing an empty chair in to aid with the discussion, but I didn't figure I could get it by security. So
you also need to give us your name for the record.
Oh, okay. Fred Messerly, Coos County Commissioner. I'm sorry.
Thanks, Fred.
Just so I don't lose track of it, your question, Senator Cruz, if I could, about 30% of Coos County is federally owned. However, we have large private timber ownerships, and they have a great deal of deferred tax, and of course, the timber tax goes to the state. So anyway, getting to the task at hand, our budget process this year, we chose to maintain function so we could maintain minimum levels of service and keep our key employees, figuring if we cut back on that, we'd never be able to bring those programs back. We had to dip into reserves a little bit over $3 million on a $21 to $22 million general fund so that we could get to a balanced budget.
70.
Our SRS payment, the 2012-13 one that will be coming, we rolled it into the 2013-2014 budget as we have historically rolled that that SRS money ahead. We've got about, the estimate is about $1.839 million to go to the general fund, but $1 million of that is already committed to the 35% bump in the PERS premium that we'll see in the 2013-14 budget. The divergence of the cost and revenue trends will not allow for sustainability into the future, and that's a great concern. Our county, Coos County, is fortunate in that we've got a county forest to be able to bridge for a few years, but again, it's not sustainable. We're eating our seed corn. We're deferred maintenance and capital investments killing us, and we're managing for the future on a crisis basis. and failures are just killing us in equipment and that sort of thing. If we can't provide basic services like public safety, public health, infrastructure planning, A&T, et cetera, nobody is going to come invest, and it just continues a downward spiral. We're out of time. The process to find a resolution to the timber management. There's some positive things. The advocacy of Mr. Tuckman from the executive side, the American Forest Resource Council work that they're doing to try to find some resolution. But the fact of the matter is a lot of these rural timber counties are going to be broke before those issues are resolved. And we have very little power or control in that process. The state needs to be a very strong advocate. I don't particularly want to talk more about the problem. I think we pretty well defined the problem. And now we need to talk about solutions. I think the quote is it's the economy, stupid. And really, rural Oregon responsible resource utilization is what's finally going to get us to the point where we can take care of ourselves. A balance of forest, agriculture, and marine resources, the wise use of that, and also commerce. We're blessed in Coos County with having the port of Coos Bay, and the significance of the development of that port as a regional economic driver can't be ignored. We have plus or minus in excess, actually, of $6 billion, that's with a B, of private investment knocking at the door in the LNG, bulk terminal, and wind energy offshore projects. Now, it's not as sexy and neat as data centers, but we can do blue collar on the coast. We that would be just fine. But six times the investment in the data centers, and not one person that I'm aware of in the state of Oregon or working for the state of Oregon gets up every morning and says, what can I do to be an advocate to move these projects ahead? And there's just something wrong with that. We need to have an effort and an advocacy at the state level to push these projects forward. We've got the tools and the process to responsibly use our resources. We just need to have the will to do it. My request is that we get some help to put together the partnerships that will allow us to take care of ourselves. Rural Oregon is on the edge of a cliff, and I don't think we want to leave a legacy to our children of poverty and failure and being referred to as the Appalachia of the West. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. When you talk about getting the help to form the partnerships, let's assume that the Wish Ferry was sitting right there. What would you ask for? What's on your list? I mean, it's very amorphous to say get the help and form the partnerships. What's on your short list of specifics?
Co-Chair Roblin, Senator Johnson, I think regulatory reform helped with the process to keep the process moving forward. Advocacy at all levels to try to move these projects along. I think those are the top priorities. The projects, interestingly enough, they're bringing the financing with them. We don't have to worry about that. And in addition to that, the state of Oregon has made a significant investment in the rail line and some port projects, which, we just can't ignore that. We certainly appreciate it.
By your leave, I just want to tease this out a little bit further. You said regulatory reform and advocacy. I know that in some parts of Oregon, and I'm just going to take a specific because I know that this project is looking at Coos Bay, in some parts of Oregon there is very aggressive, hostile response to LNG. I don't know what the sentiment is in Coos Bay, but let's assume that it was favorable. Would you then be looking for advocacy in terms of saying, yes, it would be okay to do this out of Coos Bay if it met the community standards, and the regulatory reform would speak to the notion of you could get through the permitting process in an expedited way?
Absolutely.
And what is the sentiment about the I think it's called Jordan Cove?
Right.
What is the prevailing sentiment in your community about that issue?
My sense is it's time to move forward, that we have the tools to responsibly do it. We need to get on with it.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I looked up the audit commissioner of that was done by the Secretary of State in when Commissioner Hare was talking. I was looking at Josephine's and then yours, and it's very interesting that the two counties have a striking different issue, but maybe it's symptomatic of the same problem. But I noticed in Coos County, while revenues have been similar, in a lot of the data, your debt burden is low, et cetera, but the striking statistic is that your county is getting older. And now over 50% of your county is over the age of 50. And when you look
and
at
there's
the,
something wrong with that?
Well, I'm just saying, is from a standpoint of workforce, and because what you're talking about is if you pull back regulations and do you believe, or is it your perception, that you've had a lot of your young workforce leave the county to get work, and is, do you believe that's a cultural thing happening or a consequence of over-regulation when a lot of the jobs have been amped down, workforce leaves?
Co-Chair Roblin, Representative McLean, absolutely, we have lost that age group out of our area because there's been no jobs, and it was interesting when ORC, the mineral sand company, went looking for help when they opened up a year ago last spring. 80% of their workers were either that they hired were either from Coos Bay or lived in Coos Bay and or had moved out and were anxious to come back. We don't have a big bench between 30 and 55. It's a real concern all throughout our whole community, the fact that we don't have those middle managers ready to step up and move forward and get involved in the community. The theory is, though, that if we have the jobs, the people will come.
Yeah, and just to add to that, in when I came to Coos Bay as the principal, there were 2,000 kids in the high school. When I left in 8 years ago, there were about 1,200. Today, there's about 800. That happened also in North Bend. And so it's that population that have the kids that are not there, and yet the total population of Coos Bay has increased about 1% a year. So it's just not the young families.
Exactly.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
When they were going to redistrict this past session in 2011, my district, which goes from Coos Bay to Lincoln City, had lost 10,000 people. And so they had to find 10,000 people in the redistricting. So that gives you a little bit of a perspective of what has happened on the coast.
Mm-hmm.
Our projects, in some cases, and I'm sure, Commissioner Messler, you know this, but just for the benefit of everybody, we have permitting processes taking 5 to 7 years for some of our projects.
Co-Chair Roblin, Senator Berger, exactly right. For example, we were over five years to permit the LNG slip, and in Newport it was 18 months they had the dock built and working for the NOAA fleet.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Why?
Why?
Senator and then Ms. McMahon have the same question. Have the same question.
In stereo.
I don't have the answer to that. It was basically it took that much time to get that through the permitting process.
The greenies like one, they don't like the other, pure and simple.
If I may follow up.
Representative McLean.
Well, I won't call them greenies, but I will say that there does seem to be some cynicism that when the government wants something done because of it has political wins or perceives it to be in a favoritism or some call that cronyism or whatever, things happen quickly. Mm-hmm. And when it's not, things don't happen quickly. But you've been on the ground. Is that your perception?
Co-Chair Roblin, Representative McLean, yes, it is. It's hard to explain why it would take 5 years plus to be able to get a fairly fairly straightforward permit approved. The frustration level is quite high in having to deal with that. I think the Port of Coos Bay had two dolly loads of paperwork that went along with all of that permit process. We're not asking for anything special. We just want a fair shake and process to happen in a timely manner. What we see with some of these investors that want to do a project and whatever, they're time sensitive, and if they can't get it done in Coos Bay, they'll go find it somewhere else in the world to be able to do what they need to do. And we've got Oregon is at the top of the list in having the rules and regulations to be able to protect the environment and the process. We just need to get past that point and say we're going to do something. We need to get to work.
Mr. Can I follow up one thing?
Well, no, let's go to Senator Johnson.
Follow up. I'll
and then because we need to get Doug, and I won't don't want to take too much
as we sit here, Mr. Chair and colleagues, and I looking at this audit and seeing what are very difficult data trends that tough to do. Josephine County having half its revenue per capita it had in 2004. And I come from the county with the highest unemployment. But the one thing that seems to be a consistent message that maybe we can do as a task force, because it's tough to sit here and feel helpless.
Right.
The one thing that seems to be a consistent story throughout rural Oregon is permitting time. Why it takes so doggone long to get anything done. That's on us. And you brought up data centers. We had a problem with data centers in my district. We were about to lose data centers all over the state. It was going to impact the highest unemployment in this area in the state, which is where I live. And we came together, bipartisan, bicameral, and we got it done that fast and saved an industry in Oregon. Why can't we do that in Coos Bay? And my frustration after being here one term is the consistency of this story. Why can't we do something?
And I think, in that case, and I agree, I would love to have a time certain length of time for permitting so that yes or no. I mean, our companies would like the same answers. The question would be, that one didn't take as many federal regulations. We have two groups when you talk about Coos Bay, because there's federal permitting and the others. In the case in yours, we could handle the problem that they were doing because it was a state-only situation. But there has to be some better solutions to that. So, but I thank you.
I'll be very brief.
Very brief.
I would respectfully ask the co-chairs of this committee to consider, and I hope that there's some law professor or public policy professor across the street listening, to see if we could borrow a graduate student who would be willing to juxtapose Coos Bay and Newport and to try to see what were the similarities or the differences. You both were looking to work in an in-water work window. You were both looking to build a dock. I'm just making this up because I don't know for sure. maybe there was a difference in the quality of the staff doing the writing. I don't know what it is, but I think it might be terribly instructive to take these two activities happening within a close time frame of each other and try to peel back what were the differentiating characteristics that took made one go so long and the other go so quickly.
And the permitting in Coos Bay, there's a lot of that project that was federal, but not the
not
permitting.
All.
Not the permitting of the facility.
No, not of the facility.
Okay.
Yeah. Co-Chair Roblin and Senator Johnson, we'd be more than happy to be helpful in any way we could in any kind of that endeavor.
Okay.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Doug.
Thank you.
The floor is yours.
Co-Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Doug Robertson. I'm a county commissioner in Douglas County and president of the Association of O&C Counties and vice chair of the National Forest Counties and Schools Coalition. I'll be brief this afternoon, and what I would like to do is provide some context with what is going on a national level with this same issue that you're involved with in an effort perhaps to give you some confidence that Oregon is not isolated. We are tremendously impacted by the federal forest issues, as you know, but we are not the only state that's impacted. And we have some things on the horizon that I think would be helpful at least to be aware of. First of all, there are, as we speak today, at least five other, and I say other because we have the DeFazio bill, which you're familiar with, their proposal on managing, changing the management on the O&C lands. There are five other federal initiatives being considered in the House of Representatives to deal with management on national forest lands. And of course, we have 13 national forests in the state of Oregon, which are would be dramatically impacted. Interestingly enough, to follow up a little bit with a conversation about permitting and the delays and the kinds of things that cut across all lines, I can share with you that in an effort to achieve some level of reasonable management on the O&C lands and on the national forest lands, whatever portion of those lands are being managed, it has been pretty well accepted throughout the Congress with those folks that are involved, that if you are going to see meaningful management on these lands, the authority to manage has to come out from under the federal government. As long as the National Environmental Policy Act and the Federal Endangered Species Act is there to apply, and add to that the Oregon Coastal Zone Management Act and the various things that serve as impediments, it is very easy to stop a project that a particular constituent organization doesn't want to see go forward. And so you will see in the bills that I mentioned, there are five bills, two in Idaho, one in Colorado, one in Utah, New Mexico, and then of course the DeFazio bill in Oregon. You'll see that there is an effort, whether it is to form a trust, there is an effort to get the management prescriptions out from under the federal government and to apply, in our case, for instance, the Oregon Forest Practices Act. Idaho has a Forest Practices Act. The state of Washington has a Forest Practices Act. And to supplant the federal rules and regulations with something more workable. And it does, there is a nexus with the discussion that Commissioner Messerly is having with you about the problem with permitting. and while permitting is perhaps not the right way to categorize the problems we see with federal forest management, it's the same issue. And as long as the opportunities to stop projects are there, they'll be used, and that's our position. Commissioner Hare referenced the meeting we had earlier with the governor. I think you're all aware that the governor has taken a very active role in working with the counties and the industry, the conservation community, and the congressional delegation in trying to find an answer to move forward with management, specifically on the ONC lands, and perhaps a plan that could be replicated on the national forest. And you're going to hear, of course, more about that from Mr. Tuckman a little bit later. Another issue that has in the process of raising the awareness of what's going on, the Pacific Northwest historically has been the focus of the timber issues for obvious reasons. However, as a result of a lawsuit and the settlement of a lawsuit by a federal judge in the Southeast District involving 11 southeastern states, Mississippi, Arkansas, Louisiana, Georgia, by the middle of this month, there are over 300 candidate species to be listed as endangered species. 300 all at once. And the reasons for that, they've delayed and delayed and delayed. And finally, there was a lawsuit challenging U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to go forward. The judge said, yes, you've got to do this. They will affect not only the federal forest lands down there, but private lands. The point I'm trying to make is that you're going to see more involvement on the federal level from representatives from that area than we've ever seen before. That's a positive thing. This isn't positive for them in terms of what's going to happen, but it's positive that it's raising the awareness of the issues that we're talking about that all too often we think we're isolated in here in Oregon. We're not. The other issues that you're well aware of, and we all are, of course, is the diminishing health of the federal forest system, the fires, the insect infestation, the disease, and the realization by senators like Max Baucus from Montana, Senator Feinstein from California, again, putting a different focus on an issue that we've had a hard time getting traction on that level. We're seeing as positive the reality that these federal forest lands, the treasures of this country, are diminishing in value and relative to their overall health is beginning to concern people that can make a difference. And so that's important. We're going to continue, obviously, through the Association of Oregon Counties, the Association of ONC Counties, to work with you, our congressional delegation, and the governor towards a solution. We feel energized that with that kind of leadership that we have the opportunity to bring the entire Oregon delegation together, which will be a very important role for you to help us to get behind a solution to this problem that hopefully can be replicated in other areas throughout the country. I will just leave you with a statement that the governor has made and we've used on many occasions, and that is we can no longer afford to sacrifice the good in pursuit of the perfect. There isn't a perfect, but there are a lot of good solutions being considered, and as you've heard from my colleagues and will continue to hear, time is of the essence. We have a solution in front of us. We've got to get something implemented. Thank you.
Any questions? Now, I appreciate all three of you and Doug for the global U.S. perspective. That was helpful, and some of that I had not heard that has a positive possibilities for us to have some more partners in trying to have this conversation. So I appreciate that. So thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So next in our informational meeting, we're going to have
Local Schools Task Force. Okay. So if any stuff comes, can you get it to my office?
Yeah. Okay. We're going to have an ONC trust proposal. We're going to have Tom Tuckman come up first from Forestry and Conservation Finance Advisor for the Governor's Office.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, Chair Hanna, Chair Berger. My name is Tom Tuckman. I'm the Forestry and Conservation Finance Advisor for the Governor. I had the pleasure to meet with a number of you over the last couple of months, and here to talk a little bit about the Governor's efforts on the ONC Act. You heard Commissioner Robertson summarize a little bit of that, and I can give you a little bit more detail, answer your questions, and I'm sure we'll be talking over the intervening months on as we move forward. So I would like to talk to you a little bit about our work to date, some of the principles that the Governor has developed recently, and a process that we hope to move forward with over the next couple months to build on the DeFazio Schrader Walden proposal in preparation for the next Congress. So work to date. I think some of you know I've been knocking around the federal forestry issues for about 25 years, was pretty involved in the Northwest Forest Plan, and quickly in 1998 dropped out and worked in the private sector, and it took considerable amount of time bringing myself up to speed over the first couple of months, speaking with many people. It's amazing how much has changed. It's amazing how much hasn't changed over a 15-year period on these federal forestry issues. I think it's important to put in context that I remember counting this. I was working as a staff in the U.S. Senate between 1998. I'm sorry. See, I'm dating. Between 1988 and 1992, there were something like 26 bills introduced to solve the spotted owl crisis, as was known then. I think one or two got out of a federal subcommittee.
Yeah, right.
And people talk about how their elected officials are not representative. I think it's actually maybe a little bit more the other way, that people are actually very representative of their constituents, and we've got 535 members, and as Commissioner Robertson said, it's very, very difficult to get a solution. Having said that, the Governor feels that the Northwest Forest Plan, he's been a supporter of it. He thinks a lot has worked on the conservation side, but he also believes that the plan has not hit its timber targets. I would agree with that. And he's made a commitment to get involved and use his role as governor to work at the federal level to try and reach some kind of a solution that will actually has a likelihood of success in making its way through. And we're hoping that in doing that, it will set a positive precedent for the future. In August, we spent a lot of time just bringing the governor up to speed. We've had a series of meetings with forest products industry, business, environmental, community, county commissioners over the last couple of weeks. And what we'd like to do moving forward is move into a process where we bring folks together to see if we can build on the DeFazio Walden Schrader bill. We can talk a little bit more about that, but let me talk or summarize the some of the principles that the governor has outlined to me and that might guide this process moving forward. For starters, the first is stabilize county funding. I mean, we've heard this. Recognize the ONC. There's a recognition that the ONC Act's unique community stability mandate, to my knowledge, is actually the only federal law that actually has a community stability as part of the act. I think Commissioner, well, Chief Thomas of the Forest Service said that de facto we have a de facto policy for biological diversity conservation. I think with some of the things that have gone on with the Northwest Forest Plan, that's true. And so we need to figure out a way to put some the timber supply component back into the equation. He recognizes the ONC Act's mandate, and he would like to provide adequate and stable revenue sufficient to meet basic public services. That is one of his principles in terms of a solution. The DeFazio bill does that, and he agrees with that. Stable timber supply. Provide adequate and stable timber supply that will provide for employment opportunities and forest products. This means maintaining existing mills to the extent you can. It's a market. Mills are coming and going. There's been a large reduction in mills in this state over the last 20 years. At the same time, there's been increased capacity. I mean, that's a natural part of the market. It's not a bad thing. It can be a good thing. But having said that, we need a stable supply of timber to keep the mill capacity as it exists in the current market alive and healthy. The industry has indicated that they would like 500 million board feet per year. That's more than doubling of the timber harvest on the ONC Act, on the ONC lands. Under the forest plan, it's equal to the amount in the ONC Act. It's a goal that the governor would like to achieve, although it will be, I think it's going to be a difficult one to get there, but we're going to give it a shot. Protecting unique places. There continues to be an interest in protecting unique places in this state. The DeFazio bill, I think, recognizes, and I can be corrected on this, I believe it's around 90,000 acres for special designations. The governor is supportive of that and would like to see that as part of any final solution. Durable and adaptive conservation standards. This is an area that we're going to need some work on. The DeFazio bill has strong late successional old growth protection. A lot of people don't realize, but 50% of the land in the Northwest Forest Plan that's tied up is actually due to the aquatic conservation strategy. A lot of folks think it's the owl and the old growth reserves. It's the aquatic conservation strategy, which has shown real improvement in water quality, actually ties up about 50% of the volume. The governor would like some kind of aquatic conservation strategy included in any final solution. I would note that, having said that, that there is involvement science on this issue that would recognize changes to those riparian reserves. We'd like to build that into the process and see what we can do to help that help with our timber supply goals. Conservation opportunities. That's the fifth objective. If you look at the checkerboard, federal lands are very, very important, but private lands are very important as well. And there's an interest in providing, I want to be real clear here, non-regulatory, voluntary incentives for private land conservation where a landowner would like to do that. It could be an array of things, regulatory relief, a fund to sell conservation easements, a fund for land exchanges. We think there are ways to do that in a way that protects property rights and achieves our conservation goals. The sixth goal, this isn't really something, this is something we just need to be aware of, and I think it's an important principle. We need to achieve federal budget neutrality. There's not a lot of federal money to spend on these things. That's probably why the secure rural schools is likely to go away. We need to, whatever we do, we need to be realistic at the federal level and achieve budget neutrality. And seventh, very importantly, we need to achieve certainty. The Northwest Forest Plan, I can say this because I used to say it 18 years ago, was an attempt under our nation's environmental laws to provide scientific certainty. We felt back then that if we put together a scientifically sound plan, that it didn't matter whether we got challenged, it mattered whether we won or lost. Well, there over the first 5 or 6 years, the federal government actually was starting to meet its timber targets. There were a series of lawsuits in the late 90s, early 2000s, and since that time, it's been very, very difficult to achieve any kind of regeneration harvest, and most of the timber that's been coming off of our federal forests has been through thinnings. That's not bad. Volume is volume, but it hasn't been at the level that was predicted, and it also doesn't provide the returns to the federal government that allows for county payments. In many of those thinning sales, revenues are at or just above sort of a break-even point, and for money to go back to the counties, there needs to be a significant increase in revenues. So there's a strong need for certainty. When we were first talking about this, we said, you know, do we do the administrative process or do we support the administrative process? The governor has tasked me and Department of Forestry to continue to work with the Bureau of Land Management on their planning process, and they're doing it again. But he also feels very strongly that we have to have legislation to really achieve the certainty goals that we need to provide a balance on our federal forests, and particularly the ONC lands. Let me close by just talking about, I summarized it, what we hope to do in the next couple of months. Time is of the essence. As I understand it, the Secure Rural Schools basically expires next August, I believe it is. We don't have a lot of time. So what the governor would like to do is pull together a small group of folks to see if we can come up and build on the solution in the DeFazio bill in a way that has a higher likelihood of passage in Washington, D.C. It's easy to sit here and say, we support X, Y, or Z. There's, you know, six members of the Oregon delegation. There's, what if my math is correct, 529 other members, plus the administration in Washington, D.C. And I think we can see by the global warming legislation, which everybody thought was a slam dunk and didn't go anywhere, that it's a lot easier to stop things in Washington than it is to get them passed. And the reason I took this job was to try and find a solution, and I think that will be our focus over the intervening months. We would hope to have something that we could share. You know, we hope to have consensus. We may not get it. If we don't get it, the governor will consider what his position will be, and I'm sure we'll be announcing where he is on this in late November, early December. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Senator Johnson.
This is the first time that I have heard all the principles articulated in one place. It would be extremely helpful if you could supply those principles to the committee so that we could have them as a reference to ground truth ideas that we're hearing.
Absolutely.
And try to be a gauge of what's in the realm of the doable. It would just be helpful, and I would respectfully ask for that.
Happy to do that. I'll check with my boss, but I'm happy to do that. Yep.
Senator Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess that a lot of things make sense to other people that don't make sense to me, and that's okay. That's why we're all different. But I was passing by the terminals on the waterfront when I was coming to Salem this week, and the logs are there just in stacks, and I keep driving by and looking at all of them. They're all going somewhere. Not to Oregon, but they're going out of Oregon to mills that people have allowed them to mill those logs. So it just strikes me as rather strange the way we've closed all of our mills, and so now we're sending all of this work somewhere else. The economic impacts, I hope that you will take into consideration. It seems to me that they're always lost. We do a lot of emphasis on environmental impacts to every project and every discussion that comes along. And it's very clear in law that at the same time you have to discuss and realize and take into consideration the economic impacts. And I do not believe that that is happening in Oregon. So thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Chairman.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Tuckman, for being here. Like Senator Johnson, I'm anxious to see the points because I'm not sure as I scribbled my notes as fast as I did whether I got points or talking points about the points. But what I heard was stabilize county funding, and I want to do a little process check. I'm assuming you're saying get a harvest level that stabilizes secure rural school funding.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, we want to keep, timber harvest levels are going to be part of any solution, period. The question is, what level of funding do we need? The counties have indicated and our analysis shows that $100 million is a reasonable goal. The DeFazio bill achieves 100% of that through timber harvest. If that can be achieved, if we can reach some kind of agreement, we can get that through the Congress, that'd be great. But there's folks that don't agree with that. And so the question is, are there other alternatives to look at that could get us to the same place? Secure Rural Schools is a federal program that is independent of timber harvest levels. So it's a federal payment out of the general treasury to make those payments. the DeFazio bill goes back to 100% of that payment being through timber harvest receipts. You know, either one of those are a legitimate solution. The question is, what combination of things can we have that creates the will to get something passed?
So I just want to follow up. So I understand that the SRS is really in lieu of
right.
The harvest is, hopefully we get the benefit of both the harvest right. dollars and right. the jobs right. created by right. by at least some portion of that being locally milled. All your comments, though, are about federal forests.
That's right.
Okay. The second thing I just wanted, is there additional legislation being proposed by the executive branch to what we currently see publicly of our federal delegation's plan in regard to the protection of unique places and or durable and adaptive conservation strategies? So are you yes. are you suggesting that here's the bill, but we're going to put additional conservation measures on it?
Chair Hannah, the answer to that is we don't know yet. I mean, first of all, the governor, when you speak with the executive branch, I assume you're talking about the
Certainly.
Governor. The governor obviously has a very important role to play in this. The reality is this decision has to be made by Congress and the federal administration. And having said that, the governor feels strongly that if we can come up with an Oregon solution that includes, we'd love to have 100%, but a majority of folks in the conservation community, the industry, the county commissioners, and we have an Oregon solution that we can take that back to our federal delegation, and I'm sure they will put more bells and whistles on it and introduce it in a way that we can stand strongly behind that. The governor said that if we can do that over the next couple months, I don't know what form it's going to take. It's probably not going to take the form of an alternative piece of legislation. It'll probably take the form of additional principles or additional ideas that might be considered by the Oregon delegation. We have 3 out of 5 delegation members. We need a couple more. That's sort of what I'm envisioning anyway as a work product in a couple months. And based on that, we hope that we're going to have a broader consensus on that solution, and that if we do, that will create the political will in Washington to move something forward. I think Commissioner Robertson touched on it. I mean, there's a growing interest in national forest reform around the country, but I wouldn't underestimate the folks in different parts of the country that also like the way things are. And so we need to try and come up with something that all sides will support back in Washington, D.C., not just one side or the other. So I don't know if I answered your question specifically, but...
So I think what I hear is there's a possibility that and I'm only not trying to be yeah. so personal to just the governor, but yeah. you know, you work for the governor, so I'm yeah. saying the executive branch because that's where you work, and we work on the other side of that. Sure. So just to be polite to both sides, the possibility is still that you're looking at additional conservation additives to the current piece of legislation, but the delegation isn't set on the piece of legislation we're looking at today from a federal perspective, that there's still a discussion about adding to that legislation.
Well, I can't answer Chair Roble and Chair Hannah. I can't answer that. What the governor would like to do is put a process together where folks that do not support the current legislation have an opportunity.
Okay.
Okay. It may be that there are no additional protections, but there may be that there are, and if there are, it's going to be in the context of other folks supporting it. So, you know, the governor said this. There's really a choice here. There's going to be a discussion on this. The issue is that discussion going to happen first in Oregon, or is it going to happen in Washington, D.C.? The governor's view is that we should have that discussion first here in Oregon. If we can go to Washington with a broad array of support, including the conservation community, that it substantially increases the likelihood that we're going to get something passed.
I'm going to ask one just a clarification for me. It sounds like the governor is talking with people about a plan that's bigger than just ONC. That's federal forests in general, as well as the ONC forests.
Chair Roblin, that's it's actually this process is just for the OMC.
Okay, that's what I wanted to find out. Okay,
yep.
Very good. Senator Virgin. Senator Johnson.
Close. Sorry. Based on the last exchange between the two co-speakers and you, I am a little bit mystified. Listening to you speak, I didn't realize in the beginning that these principles applied only to the federal legislation. And I'm wondering how much of what is reflected in these principles is exportable into the management of our state forests. I didn't realize until Speaker Hanna asked his question that you were limiting your comments and principles only to the federal legislation.
Chair Roebling, Senator Johnson, that is correct. My task is to work on the federal ONC lands, the 2.1, 2.6 million acres, depending on how you calculate it, lands that are managed primarily by the Bureau of Land Management and a small portion by the Forest Service.
Then I would ask the rhetorical question, if these principles have durability in a federal context, why couldn't we apply the same thing to our state-owned forests, which have cried out for certainty, which have cried out for perhaps some of the conservation incentives or some speak to private owners to give them the incentive to keep their logs off the export dock and to put them to work in our mills? I'm just asking rhetorically, if it's good for Congress, why isn't it, and federal lands, why isn't it good for us?
Well, Chair Roebling, Senator Johnson, I that's something I could certainly bring up with the governor. I think the immediate crisis is the ONC lands, and I know my view anyway is you've got to start somewhere. The ONC lands are a large enough piece of land that if we reach some kind of agreement here, it may serve as a good precedent for other federal lands, other state lands.
I would just respectfully respond that, yes, the ONC is a crisis, but it's a crisis when a mill in any one of our districts closes and 100 people are out on the street.
Agreed.
I want to thank you. We've got a lot of stuff left to get done, so I appreciate it, and I think we can talk to our state forest lands, because I think we manage them in a slightly different way, and we've moved forward, actually, with the our school lands by getting away from what was trying to have a special agreement with the federal government to moving like the private forests are being managed, and I'm appreciative of what the state board has done there in moving forward and using our state lands a little bit more effectively than we
Thanks
have been
time.
Able to. So thank you.
Yep.
And so next we'll have Tom Parton, Chief Executive Officer for the American Forest Resource Council.
Co-Chairs Roebling, Hanna, Verger, members of the committee, thank you very much for the invitation. My name is Tom Parton. I'm actually president of the American Forest Resource Council. We're located in Portland, Oregon. Our members are in five western states, but heavily located here in Oregon. Most of our members depend on a certain degree to public and federal timber, much like we're talking about off the ONC lands, and many of our members are located in rural Oregon communities, which is really important in my opinion. Today I want to make the case for the ONC trust proposal, which we're talking about, and which Mr. Tuckman talked a little bit about, and the governor and he are taking a look at it. And first of all, I like to use a PowerPoint. I'm going to be talking about some facts and figures, and it works out better for me because I can't remember them. And also, I think we need to look at the history. We need to look at the current situation, and we need to look at a path forward. So why do we need legislation on ONC County forest lands? Well, first of all, the BLM, in my opinion, currently lacks direction on the 2.5 or 2.6 million acres of timberland that they are managing. They've been managing this under the Northwest Forest Plan since 1993. On those lands, we have Matrix, we have LSR lands, and pretty much the Matrix lands, which we were promised we could do regeneration harvest on. We've lost that opportunity. We're doing primarily thinnings, and we have not hit our targets over the last 20 years off of those lands, so really we're not being effective under the Northwest Forest Plan. From 2003 to 2008, the BLM worked on a new plan called the Western Oregon Plan Revision. This five-year plan, in my opinion, had the best science. The first draft of that plan came out with an allowable harvest of $728 million. The final draft came out at $502 million, which does fit under the rules and regulations of the ONC Act. But upon the Obama administration taking over in, I guess it was 2008, they pulled the plan. Secretary Salazar pulled the plan early in 2009, and we never had a chance to operate under that. Currently, while we're supposed to be under the Northwest Forest Plan, we have some forestry under Johnson and Franklin at work out there. What they're doing is looking at some what they call dirty clear-cutting, skips and gaps. And however, these pilot projects are getting appealed right now and not moving forward as well. Now, on top of that, we have a new planning process that was introduced by the BLM on March 9th. That kind of convolutes the whole process. Are we supposed to be under the Northwest Forest Plan? Are we supposed to be under Johnson and Franklin? Or are we going to be doing a new planning and work on that for 3 years? So it really leaves us in a state of quandary as to where we are. In the meantime, the only thing that are moving forward are thinnings. We don't have regeneration harvest to speak of. We don't have older age classes being harvested, which really are needed by many of our sawmills in Oregon, as particularly on the west side. Now we somebody mentioned it earlier, we have the new spotted owl critical habitat coming out. Lord only knows how much land that's going to take. We've heard from the BLM that that could be 50% of their land base that's going to be impacted. And if we're only looking at 200 million feet of harvest, that could, we could lose another 100 million just with the critical habitat from the owl. And obviously, we're not returning adequate money back to the counties. Visuals are always good. Here's where we were back in the 80s and early 90s. Historically, those ONC lands had produced about a billion board feet. You can look at the rapid decline in harvest following the Northwest Forest Plan. And as you get down to 1994, the government said enough is enough. Our counties are suffering. We've really broken the contract with rural America that we promised you, and we aren't paying taxes. We're paying you on stumpage receipts. And so they started paying the counties, the owl counties first in 1994, and then the secure rural counties starting in 2000, and you've had a consistent payment base up until 2010 or 2011 when they started falling off the table. We keep hearing from the environmental community and a lot of others, well, let's just thin out there. Let's just talk about thinning on our forests. It's well, it's palatable. Society appreciates it and accepts it. The problem is on the ONC lands, we don't have that much thinning left. If you look particularly at the Roseburg District and the Medford District, we have about 3 years of thinning left before we have covered the areas that were once harvested, planted into regeneration areas, and now they're back thinning those areas. So we've got a problem with just doing the thinnings. I want to talk a minute about the Medford District. It's really at ground zero for the problems with the ONC counties, both the Roseburg District and Medford District. They have a variety of species out there, ponderosa pine, dryland Douglas fir, that often do better in selective management. So most of the acres on the Roseburg and Medford districts have been selectively managed with old growth components throughout all of the acres. That has worked to their negative parts, because the environmental community only want to do thinnings in younger age classes. And so what has been prescribed for the Medford District, PSQ or sale quantity of 57 million, we've been woefully short, only hitting about 20 or 22 million, I guess it was 20 million in 2010 and 2011. This is a chart I showed before back in January of sawmills that are open today in yellow and the ones in black have closed. And if you look down in southwest Oregon around the Medford area, you see a tremendous amount of black dots. And that's primarily due to the ratcheting down of the ONC program and the mills we've lost in the Medford, Cave Junction, Grants Pass area, primarily due to the number of reduction and cut. This is the fiscal year 12 sale volume by the BLM this past year. Actually, it was up a little bit. It had been around 185 to 200 million. They brought additional volume on partly because some of the sales that were supposed to be sold last year didn't get sold, so they brought it forward. But anyway, Salem and Eugene are very heavy to areas that are plantations, and they have the thinnings, and they're not protested as much. At least they weren't. But Roseburg and Medford are the two districts, again, that are suffering with the lowest sale quantities and really are providing a lot of the problems that we're facing right now. So I want to talk a little bit about BLM protests and lawsuits. This is something new. We've had a few of them over the years, mostly on the Forest Service, but very few on the BLM. We have a protest period and a resolution program that usually you can get them resolved, but lately that isn't the case. The Salem District, which is mostly thinnings, right now has 22 million feet tied up. The Coos Bay District, which is a pilot project, has got 6 million feet tied up. Roseburg BLM has 5.3 million, two of which is a pilot project. Medford BLM, 62.5 million feet tied up on that district. And the total is 96.4 million board feet of timber litigated, tied up, held up. 8 million of that are pilot projects, 27.8 million feet are thinnings, which of course we've heard the environmentalists tout again and again that that's the way to go forward. The people that are doing most of the litigation, I put it down here because I think folks need to know, it's KS Wild and it's Oregon Wild. They're the main appellants. Let's talk a minute about what that's done to Title $1, at least where that's been over the last few years with secure rural school payments back to the counties. In 2001, when it was first started, Oregon was receiving about $221.5 million. 2010, when it started ratcheting down, we went to $181.2 million. 2011, it was really dropped off at $104 million. And, of course, it's this year it ratcheted down at 5% again. And if it goes in the future years, that's what they're predicting, is a 95% of the previous year. So it's going to be a death spiral. And I've heard some of the counties say we're in permanent poverty at this level and we can't operate, just what I'm hearing today. It's a non-starter. I just put some of the fallouts from the county budget reduction. It's things that I've heard, and I actually called some other people today, and I was kind of mistaken here with the facts that I put down. Lane County, I guess, let 199 prisoners loose because of the sheriff's staffing. Two murders have been committed by those prisoners. Apparently there was one stabbing in Eugene and one shotgun murder at a Walmart parking lot. 2 weeks ago, a lady called 911 asking for help because she was being assaulted in Josephine County because of lack of sheriff. It took an hour and a half to get out there, hour and 25 minutes, I guess, according to the records. When they found her, she was unconscious, beaten, and raped in her driveway. The third thing I'll mention is 3 weeks ago, Lane County let out 199 prisoners, three of whom were waiting trial for murder. And this is not a way we want to run our counties or we want to run our social system, but that's what we're forced into with where our county payments are right now. And I not only feel sorry for our industry, but I feel sorry for you folks trying to run your counties and trying to make sense of what has happened to you. You've been dealt a bad blow. I want to talk and shift gears now to what we can do and what we can do to be proactive. And I think there's been a lot of work done by DeFazio, Schrader, and Walden on this ONC Trust Conservation and Jobs Act. We first heard about it. It was first introduced on February 16th. The discussion draft was released. Obviously, it was done by all three of our representatives, DeFazio, Schrader, and Walden. We thought it would be the second part of the Hastings bill that really talked about the Forest Service lands. So far, it has not had a hearing. It hasn't been placed as part of the Hastings bill. It's still out there kind of in limbo. So we've been disappointed on the time frame, to tell you the truth, and that's why we're very pleased to see this committee, to see the governor, to see Tom Tuchman pick this up and try to move it forward. A few things that I want to just talk about that are in the discussion draft that I think merit our attention and really have some good points. First of all, it's going to transfer ONC timberlands less than 125 years of age to an ONC trust, which will be managed under the Oregon Forest Practices Act, not managed under all of the NEPA, not under all of the judicial reviews that we have in our federal forests. And it's going to be geographically distributed on the ONC lands. And that way we won't get the numbers that are flip-flop from Medford to Salem to Eugene. And I think that's a really integral part of it. All the counties need dollars. All of our industry needs timber to operate on. 50% of the trust lands managed will be on a rotation 50% a rotation of 100 to 125 years, meaning we're not just going to go in and look at an industrial way of managing the timberlands at a 45 or 50-year rotation only, and the rest of it's not going to have older age classes. We're really going to look at and maintain some of those older age classes to give an opportunity for a lot of the other amenities out there, whether it be wildlife. It's going to provide some product for our members that need a larger diameter log, not old growth per se, but a larger diameter log. And I think it really has some good concepts. The other 1.6 million acres, the Forest Service is to assume management of those lands with existing old growth protections on them. The management will allow outside, let's just say there's no restrictions or requirements other than projects such as salvage, forest health, et cetera. So while they're going to be transferred to the Forest Service, they're not going to have a lot of restrictions on them, and they're not just going to be totally off the table. Currently with this trust, it's a trust board made up of 7 members, 2 from industry, 2 from county commissioners, nominated by the counties, approved by the governor, 1 statewide elected official or members of a tribe, 1 general public member, and 1 scientist. The trust board has a fiduciary responsibility to county beneficiaries under strong trust mandate. Continuing on with some of the other important aspects of this, all existing export restrictions will apply from these lands. Auctions, competitive auctions of timber sales with at least half of all the timber sold at oral auctions, and the trust would set aside sales based on the SBA rules. And of course, that's important to our current makeup of members, which some of them are small, some of them are large, some like seal bids, some like open bids. There's only going to be allowed 1 lawsuit once this legislation moves forward, and the lawsuit would be held in the D.C. court. It wouldn't be held out here in the Ninth Circuit, which of course we all know leans fairly liberal. The court must rule within 180 days. If a court strikes down the act, it reverts back to the present state, which is under the Northwest Forest Plan right now. Any of the wilderness language in the legislation would go away. It would also prioritize ground application of herbicides and pesticides to the greatest extent practical. The bill does not absolutely rule out aerial application, but really focuses on ground application because we know that's controversial. If the ONC Trust protects currently occupied northern spotted owl nests consistent with the forest practices rule in Oregon, then management under the ONC Trust lands by the Board of Trustees should be considered to comply with the ESA take provisions, meaning that if it's managed under the Oregon Forest Practices Act, that's adequate. We don't need lawsuits, or we won't have lawsuits for further protection of the owl. And again, Mr. Tuckman was talking about unique places. Under this bill, the Rogue Wilderness, the Devil's Staircase Wilderness, the Molalla River, the Chetco River Wild and Scenic are part of the trade-offs that are in this draft and would be set aside for those unique places. Will it work? Yes, it will work. And how do we know? Because it's working to our brethren in one state north of us. The DNR right now has a very strong trust concept, trust mandate on their lands of 2.2 million acres. Some statistics that point out that it'll work. In the year 2000, the DNR sold 515 million board feet. The revenues from that was 164 million. In 2010, which was one of our worst markets that we've had in recent memory, DNR sold $550 million, but yet realized $150 million in revenue. The average from 2000 to 2010, the DNR has sold $566 million. The revenues are $168.6 million, or $308 per 1,000 board feet. And if you compare that to the pathetic operations on the Washington U.S. National Forest, which have 9.3 million acres, they sold an average of 129.2 million board feet per year at a revenue of $5 per thousand. We're doing something drastically wrong on our federal forests. We're doing something right on the Washington State DNR forests, and I think they can be copied here in Oregon. And finally, I'm reaching out to you folks because county and industry needs the governor and the legislature to weigh in. We can't wait three more years for the BLM to do their plannings, which will still be under the auspices of NEPA and under the ESA. As you know, county payments are going to expire next year. If we get a one-year extension, they'll probably be at 95% of what you receive this year, which is permanent poverty. Oregon forest products industry needs consistent flow of federal timber to grow. We are right on the cusp of our markets taking off. We've seen increases in housing. We've seen increases in demand. Our prices for our product are going up. We need public timber to operate on to make sure that we're able to grow. And lastly, more importantly to you folks, rural communities need the jobs and they need the dollars. So thank you very much for your time and allowing me to make some presentation here on data.
Any questions? I just want to thank you. I thought that was as good a briefing about what the Act actually does that I've had. And I've looked it over. I've been in others, and I appreciate that.
Absolutely. It has some good things. As Mr. Tuckman said, they might be able to build on it or take a different perspective. There are some very strong sideboards on there that I think the counties need and the industry needs. Industry and the ONC Act has all along called for a minimum of 500 million board feet. And also the counties, of course, you folks need a minimum of somewhere between 100 million to operate.
Right.
And if we are going to make this work, those are some really important sideboards.
Thanks. Senator Virgie?
Yes, Mr. Parton, do you agree with the principles that you heard Mr. Tuckman outline as to the federal legislation?
Co-Chair Roblin and Senator Virgie, we had a meeting with the governor and Mr. Tuckman earlier this week. It was the first time that we had a chance to really look at the seven principles, and just like Representative Hanna, I was writing them down so fast that I needed a little clarification. I think they're good principles. I think the devil's in the details of what each one of them mean. You heard Mr. Tuckman talk today about maybe pushing back from that 500 million board feet. That gives us a little concern. We think that the bill has addressed some of the unique areas, and the discussion that we've had from our industry group, there are actually some of our industry that really didn't support the ONC discussion draft as it was presented, but we did have a majority of our folks. So I think it's going to take more discussions, and we certainly want to be at the table. We applaud the governor for his efforts in getting engaged in this. It's going to take all of us to get something passed for the forest, the industry, and for our counties.
A very quick follow-up. Do you believe that there are a number of Oregonians that do not support the legislation, the DeFazio-Schrader legislation?
I think there's a minority of Oregonians that do not support it. If you look at the polling numbers that Oregon Forest Industries Council, OFRI, Oregon Forest Resource Institute, excuse me, Paul, have put together over the last few years, 70% of our population want to see our forest managed, want to see our forest maintain a green color instead of being burned up. So I think you're going to see a majority of Oregon that wants to see this bill move forward. I think we need to work with, as Mr. Tuckman said, two or three of our Oregon delegation to make sure that they understand that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yep, Senator Johnson.
Excuse me for having to step out. You made the comment that you want to be at the table. Do you have any assurance that you will be at the table?
Yes, Mr. Tuckman and the governor at our meeting said that there's going to be representatives, as I understand it, from the forest products industry, from the counties, from the environmental community, and probably others that are involved in this two-month dialogue, trying to find a solution and move forward and maybe reshape a little bit of the ONC Trust proposal.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Certainly.
Our next group from the Federal Forest Land Advisory Committee, Brett Brownscombe, Russ Wolflink, and Paul Barnum. I have to slip away about 15 for a few minutes.
Okay.
You want me to take it?
Yeah.
Thank you, Co-Chair Roblin. Co-Chair Hannah Roblin and Berger, Co-Chairs Brett Brownscombe with the Governor's Office. I work for the Governor on Natural Resources as a policy advisor, and this, as you've heard, in addition to myself, Tom Tuckman and Richard Whitman, we're all plugged in various ways on the federal forest issue, Tom most acutely on the ONC. This, what we're here to present about on this panel is the non-ONC portion of Oregon related to counties, especially in fire-prone, high fire risk areas of the east side of our state, the southern part of our state, on lands managed by the National, by the U.S. Forest Service, not BLM. Like Senator Johnson pointed out, there are also, even though there is a highly acute need for community support, county revenues, and support for mill infrastructure in the ONC counties, other counties are also facing severe issues related to federal forest management or the lack thereof. So I won't go into this too far, but the reason we're here is back in April, the task force submitted a letter to the governor's office asking the Federal Forest Advisory Committee, which I convene on behalf of the governor, to engage in and conduct an economic assessment tied to the costs and benefits of increased federal forest management on the dry side forests in areas of the highest risk of fire and loss of mill infrastructure in the state, on the east side of the state, in the southern part of the state, seven national forests in particular. I penned a response on behalf of the governor to the task force submitted last month, I believe, and for those that don't have it, I can get it to you. The status in brief is the economic assessment's on time, on budget. We have a draft that's set to come out in October, a report from Mason Bruce Gerard conducting the assessment will come to the Federal Forest Advisory Committee in November 25th, and I'd like to let you all know anybody on the task force or otherwise in the legislature would be more than welcome to have them there and hear the report out. It'll be the first time the advisory committee has heard about the assessment's results, and then in December the assessment will be final and presented as a part of the Oregon Business Summit in Portland. So the assessment really is not the issue that my colleagues to my left and right, who also are part of the Federal Forest Advisory Committee, want to talk about. The assessment ties to the bigger issue of increasing federal forest management on the east side in southern Oregon, dry side forests. And we are talking management. It's not a four-letter word. Active management tied to the benefits that it provides to communities, mills, jobs, and forest health. So with that in mind, I won't prolong this any further. I want to respect the task force's time and turn to Paul Barnum to my left, who will talk more about who the FFAC is and who the diverse stakeholders that are on that body are and what we're doing.
Okay. Thank you, Brett. Chair Roblin, co-chairs, members of the task force, my name is Paul Barnum. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Forest Resources Institute, OFRI, we call it. And since 2009, I have been participating as a member of the Federal Forest Land Advisory Committee Implementation Working Group. We'll call it the IWG for short. This is a volunteer group. It's convened by the governor's natural resources advisor, and its diverse members are committed to addressing the federal forest crisis in Oregon and restoring economic vitality to the state's rural areas. When I say diverse, participants include state agencies such as ODF, Department of Energy, DEQ, Fish and Wildlife, OWEB, OFRI, federal agencies such as the Forest Service and BLM, environmental and conservation groups such as the Craig Law Center, the Nature Conservancy and Sustainable Northwest, associations such as Oregon Counties, American Forest Resources Council, the Oregon Business Council, and Native American Tribes. It's facilitated by Oregon Solutions. So while collaboration sometimes gets minced around, we've been doing this or modeling collaboration on a statewide scale. And the group is focused on supporting landscape scale active restoration of federal forest lands by identifying and removing barriers to restoration of forest and watershed health. And so, as Brett mentioned, one of the barriers that we saw is that we didn't have good data around what would be the economic implications of basically doubling the rate of forest restoration in our national forests in eastern Oregon and in the southern interior. And so, by virtue of this
group asking us to take this on, or we asking you to ask us to take it on. We independently raised $100,000 from state and private sources. We conducted a transparent statewide interview process or search and came up with a highly qualified team led by Mason Bruce Gerard out of Portland. They began the work on July 1st. Brett's kind of given you a summary of where we're at with that. I would just kind of add that they're done with the data collection. They're putting together the economic models that will provide the information to us on jobs and income, taxes paid, avoided costs such as food stamps, unemployment, avoided costs of fire, etc. The team's also using data collected earlier this year for OFRI, for the 2012 Forest Report, which is a comprehensive economic assessment of Oregon's forest sector. That is being prepared right now, and the results will be published in October. But I can tell you that that report will strongly recommend reintroducing active management of the federal forest estate. For the National Forest Economic Assessment, team members will finalize their results by the end of September. We'll begin drawing conclusions, writing the narrative. A draft manuscript, Brett slightly misspoke, we are scheduled to discuss this on October 25th. We will give an invitation to each of you to participate in that discussion as we look at that first draft. And then the final will be due in November. And then we are scheduled to present a final report to this task force at your meeting on December 11th. For your information, there is in the packet that Christy handed out a set of FAQs. So that answers more questions about who's on the team, why we're doing this, what forests we're looking at, so forth. We also have the draft outline of the report itself. And I was reminded this morning, so I'll just bring your attention to it, too. The little graphic on the back page, that's a model. Don't take those numbers to the bank. It's just a model of what it could look like or what it will look like. Thank you. Well, I want to turn it over to Russ at this point, and who's going to speak more about how we intend to use the report.
Members of the committee, I'm Russ Hoflick, the director of the Nature Conservancy. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. I just want to be really brief. We do have, I think, an extraordinary opportunity in front of us. We have about 9.5 million acres of land that is way outside of its natural condition, and due to the hard work and support of leadership of the Forest Service, we have standing volume that needs to be taken out, thinned, and put to productive use in our state. We could either stand by and watch that forest land burn, or we could put it to productive use and reemploy the unemployed, and we can improve the biological condition of our state. I don't think we need an economic study to tell us that we need to take some action. The question is, we have a national government that is broke. We cannot rely upon them to increase the scale and pace of the work that is needed out there. The question is, what will we do as a state to reemploy the people and find pragmatic, unique state solutions to get the job done? We're here to work with you, if you would like, to try to find a pragmatic Oregon solution to keep these mills in place, to put the people back to work, and do it in the Oregon way. We have to do this. There's too much at stake to wait for the federal government, who's not in a position to do the job. Thank you.
Senator Ferriello.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, not questions for the panel so much as observations, and I think principles that we need to think about. First of all, we need to confront the fact that since forest restoration has become the primary focus of management actions on the federal forests have been perishing at an unprecedented rate. So whatever it is that we're defining as forest restoration isn't producing restored forest, it's producing forest fires and bug infestations and more mortality. And all you need to do to prove that is go back and look at the last 10-year mortality survey. We do one every year as a cooperative survey between all forest landowners. The BLM Forest Service and the State Forest do a collaborative mortality survey. And it's shocking. You know, we've been talking about forest restoration, Forests are dying, mills are closing. So the rhetoric about forest restoration is just a hoax. Secondly, Mr. Chair and co-chairs, there's a set of principles that we need to pay attention to. There are only so many mills left on this landscape, and every one of those mills has a prescription for sustainability. You can talk to the mill manager, and they will tell you that the diameter of their break-even piece size, the species that they need, the length of the log that is a break-even length, and the volume that they need to keep one shift working, which isn't necessarily a viable mill, it's just keeping a shift working, is well known to the mill managers, but apparently not well known to the timber sale planners, because they are not offering the volume, species, length, and diameter to keep even a mill working and even a shift working. And if you want proof of that, simply look at the three mills that have closed or are about to be closed in Grant County, Oregon. In a forest that produces an annual biological potential of 400 million board feet, who has an allowable sale quantity of 200 million board feet, the Forest Service there produces 26 or 27 million board feet, only 17 million of which is saw logs. And so with a mill that needs 60 to 70 million board feet to stay open, 17 million is a death sentence. And that's exactly what we're seeing played out in that county. Another principle is that we're working mostly with the rhetoric of environmental activism. We're doing ecosystem management and measuring our success by the number of acres treated. Nowhere in the discussion of ecosystem management is there an emphasis placed on the production of the saw logs needed to keep the mill open. The number of saw logs is an accidental production, it's a byproduct, it's an ancillary, it's almost a special forest product now. So we're treating a lot of acres, we're doing a lot of restoration, but we're not paying a lot of attention to the volume that's being produced, particularly in the proper diameter. There's still a 21-inch diameter restriction on east side, dry side forests that literally makes it difficult or impossible to produce the kind of volume needed to keep mills open. If we're to find a solution, two things have to happen in addition to this diameter, species, length, and volume thing that are very specific to each mill. And the two things are this. We need to stop saying that ecosystem management produces saw logs and say that saw log production pays for ecosystem management. It's a slight change in our thinking, but we've been so gun-shy about producing the volume needed to keep mills open because we need to keep the mills open. We're afraid to talk about setting volume targets and appropriating funds that are connected to those volume targets, as we used to do when Oregon's forests were healthy and we had a vibrant sawmill industry in Oregon. So a change in emphasis. Start talking about saw log production as a way to provide income to pay for ecosystem restoration instead of doing ecosystem restoration hoping that it produces saw logs. That doesn't work, and we've proven that over the last decade or so. The final thing that we need to do is recognize that we can agree in this building on a legislative solution that will fail. And we can ask for and obtain an executive branch solution that will fail. And we can look at what the judicial branch does to the executive and the legislative solutions, and that will create failure. There must be coordination between the three branches of government with the objective that we need to sustain communities and sustain ecosystems. And if the judiciary has no way to work with the executive and the legislative branch other than through litigation in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, nothing that we produce in this building or in Washington, D.C. will withstand the judicial reviews that will be inevitable. The same thing is true with the executive. A well-meaning executive is a wonderful thing, and executive orders and the commitment of human and financial resources toward a solution is a wonderful thing. But unless the executive branch is closely coordinated with the federal and state legislative branch, and all of them are having a dialogue with the judicial branch, those three branches of government will work effectively against each other for resolution. as we do so well with virtually everything that we do. So I guess what I'm saying is, look, it comes down to diameter, volume, species, and length. It comes down to volumes tied to appropriations and appropriations tied to timber volumes. It comes down to changing the emphasis from ecosystem management to accidentally produced timber volume to timber volume production to programmatically produce income to pay for ecosystem restoration. That's the way the thing is supposed to run. And without a solution that involves all three branches of government, there will not be a solution. And other than that, I have no strong feelings about any of this stuff.
And is there any questions for this panel?
Questions for the panel? We had an ample opportunity, at least Mr. Hoflick and I had ample opportunity to talk about all the issues that I thought should be their meat and potatoes as they move forward.
Okay, thank you. Senator Johnson.
I've listened with great interest to what you've said, and I guess the answer, the question that I would pose to my colleague with the chair's permission is, if the outcome is acceptable, that there are proper saw logs in length, diameter, and species, does it matter what the nomenclature is?
Madam Chair, to my good colleague from Astoria, I think it does. And here's the thing. I don't want to do a bait and switch agreement with people at the table and wink and nod and say, look, we're talking about ecosystem management, but we're really talking about 70 million board feet from the Malheur National Forest to keep Malheur lumber open, which is what they need. Because people not at the table will think that we're talking about ecosystem restoration, and when they see saw logs as the primary objective or even an objective, they'll sue. You know, the point is, unless we're honest about what we need to do, which is you've got to infrastructure and a workforce that needs to be preserved as, in order to get the ecosystem treatments completed. If you lose the workforce or the infrastructure, there's no amount of money available to pay for the ecosystem restoration, and the whole shebang burns up. We lose the watersheds, the recreation, and the wildlife. But if we tell people, look, in a bankrupt central government, the way to pay for ecosystem restorations is to put people to work in the woods, and they have to get this minimum volume to pay the rent. If you're out front about that, then we can argue about what is sustainable in terms of a volume and the diameter size and how many acres get treated and all that stuff. But at the end of the day, if you don't hit the volume target, the mill closes, you lose the infrastructure, and the workforce moves on. So let's not tap dance around the issue. Let's be honest with ourselves. Treating acres fails if the product of timber products or timber volume is accidental. You know, we're accidentally agreeing to close the mills and burn the forests. You know, we have to be more intentional about it, and one of the intentions should be honesty with the environmental community and citizens and taxpayers. We have to have 700 million board feet, or I don't know what the number is. I mean, we have to figure out what our capacity left is and what we need to keep that those mills open. At least in terms of the immediate problem in Grant County, it's probably 60 to 70 million board feet, well within the biological potential of the forest. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the all of the Iron Triangle Forest, the Umatilla, the Wallowa Whitman, and the Malheur, the total biological potential is three times higher or six times higher than we would need to keep a timber sale program operating in that area sustainably. So I think to a certain extent, by not being honest about the need to produce saw logs, we've allowed ourselves to be pushed into a place where you can't produce saw logs. And that's our problem. If we were producing saw logs, we'd be producing surpluses and counties wouldn't be facing bankruptcies.
Thank you, gentlemen. I really do appreciate you coming. You know, Russ, I think I've told you congratulations before on your marketing. You fairly effectively traded the term logging for treatment, and I think Senator Ferrioli talked about maybe that's a great idea, maybe it isn't. I'm looking at the document, this document here, so I just want to ask the question, would one be able to put an equal sign between the term restoration and harvest based in this document?
Co-Chair Roblin, Co-Chair Hanna, Co-Speaker Hanna. So I'll turn to my other colleague for additional answers, but I would say yes. But I think just to elaborate on,
on Senator Farioli's point here is he's right to point out that if you're trying to keep a sawmill running, you need saw logs. It's a sawmill. And that's right on. I think where the governor's is on this is he clearly wants to lean into the federal forest issue, and he has through his addresses to the Board of Forestry and then through his regional solutions folks, Greg Wolf and his local staff, as well as his folks, including me in the Natural Resources Office. We're working on, specific to the Malheur Mill situation, Senator Farioli, something there, and you're right to point out, the Forest Service needs to look at saw log specifications, and I think I'm happy to say that through the efforts so far on this, the Forest Service, in a letter from the regional forester to Senator Wyden and the rest of the Oregon delegation, has acknowledged this. So I think we're on the right track. The positive end of where we're trying to go with the Malheur challenge, and there are not just the Malheur Lumber Company, but other mills that are closed. It's not just the threat of closure, it's what to do with existing closures in Grant County. The issue there is we're not just talking about those mills in that county. We're talking about the entire east side of the state, and in many cases we're talking about the large part of the western United States in dry fire-prone forests. And so the one thing that the collaborative effort on the Malheur has done is identified ample acreage for the Forest Service to go out and treat to get the log volume that the mill needs. The thing that the collaborative can't solve, and that I think, acknowledging your other point, Senator, which I think is right on, even if the governor makes this his highest priority, it's going to take work with not just the federal delegation, but the state legislature on this, because some things the collaboratives can't really crack and solve themselves relate to bigger picture solutions, like how do we get the costs of planning down? And what do we do on funding where you've got certain hard costs related to funding, unrelated to planning, but where planning is part of it, where the Forest Service just isn't going to have the money? And so I think having a conversation with this task force or a subset of you on finding some solutions on both the funding issues and the cost reduction issues would be very welcome, I know, by the governor, and I think it's safe to say on behalf of the entire Federal Forest Advisory Committee, we certainly want the legislature in the conversation on this.
I appreciate that greatly. I'll come back to you in just a moment. Our other co-chair had to step out for a moment. I just want to make a couple of points here so that as we all read through this, or as we get it electronically, or as you send this out, that when you use statements like, we are assuming that no barriers exist to prohibit the increased pace of forest restoration. Now, that's why I ask, does restoration equal harvest? Because to one person, restoration might be tearing culverts out, removing roads, and going back to a more wilderness-type activity. To others, restoration certainly might mean harvest, and harvesting at a sustainable level, keeping roads because we want to have good fire suppression opportunities and those kind of things. So I think when you put it in there, you're going to have to help us a little with the definition as you go forward, because you know, we've replaced words that some of us might be normally understanding differently, and treatment and restoration are two in which they go a little different. I mean, normally you go to the doctor for treatment, and you don't take your forest for treatment, but hopefully you'll clear that up with us and help us understand that. Further questions of this panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much. We appreciate you coming.
Thank you.
I know we'll have a lot more dialogue as we move forward.
Look forward to it.
Thank you.
Mr. Speaker.
Yes.
I do have a question. I'm trying to understand the timing of all of this. You have spoken of a draft report in October, finalizing it before this committee in December. The deadline for pre-session filing of bills is the 17th. I don't know what you're planning in terms of when you say legislative action, whether you already have legislation keyed up and in drafting. I'm just trying to understand what's going on. And if you have legislation in drafting, where's the transparency?
Co-Chair Hannah, Co-Chair Verger, and Senator Johnson, what I think, and I'll allow, I see Russ is itching over there, so I'll allow Russ to elaborate on this, but what we're
primarily talking about is a conversation related to budgets and state partnerships. There is one legislative concept that's in the hopper related to something that this task force worked on last session that we are interested in having a conversation around, which is the use of county road funds and the flexibility in the use of those funds for counties in increasing federal forest management. There also is a need to have to fully make a concept around this work to get the federal government to free up flexibility, and so it's a joint conversation. But Russ, if you want to expand on the larger piece of this, that'd be great.
Sure. So you have federal government that does not have the capacity to do the planning. If you think about the Boise Cascade situation where they're going to run out of timber in the next 2 years, and we have many other mills that are running at bare minimum capacity. You're right, Senator Ferrioli, we do clearly understand the volume issues, what is needed to get into the mill on time, but we have to plan to get we have to have the NEPA planning, we have to have the community collaborative visions enforced and supported. There simply isn't federal resources identified to get that to happen. So we have a choice. We will watch those mills shut down because we did not have sufficient resources to plan, and you will have a greater burden to have additional people on in the unemployment rolls, or the state can make a choice to find a way to invest in the planning and reemploy the people in these communities and put them to work taking care of the resource. We can't do that ourselves. We're sitting in the collaborative meetings once every 6 weeks identifying the barriers. You have the solutions, and we're happy to work with you to find those solutions, but we're going to need state resources to make it happen.
Follow-up?
Yes.
Can you be brief, Senator Johnson? We've got a pretty good panel left to go.
We need specifics, and we need them soon.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen, thank you so much for coming. We appreciate it. We have a final two groups that I'll introduce, and I'd ask that the first four, so if you can bring up one more chair as a group, John Phillips from the Office of the Chief Operating Officer, Department of Administrative Services, Brenda Bays, Elections Division Manager from the Secretary of State's Office, Mark Long, Building Codes Division Administrator from the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and Tom Mann, Department of Veterans Affairs. And I'll let you all plan out your schedule. Please introduce yourselves as you get started. And the first one of you who is ready, please proceed.
Good afternoon. Excuse me. Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Phillips, and as you said, I'm representing the Office of the Chief Operating Officer, Department of Administrative Services. Thank you for the opportunity to come today to talk to you about a couple of legislative concepts that we're working on for the 13th session. The first concept really is sort of in the background of the whole discussion that's been going on this afternoon about funding and how to deal with forests and timber harvest. But in the event, unfortunate event that a county is unable to fund certain services, we are trying to plan for that eventuality and think about how we can work to continue services to the public and to local governments and to the private business community out there in the event a county has these services fall through their hands with the funding situation. So the first concept we wanted to talk about is one that really has four components, and it deals with the elections, veteran services officers, building codes and inspections, and then the tax collection function of the county. So I'd like to turn it over to the experts in those areas and have those discussions.
Great. Thank you. We appreciate it.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Hannon, Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brenda Bays. I am the Deputy Director for the State Elections Division. Ours is rather quick here. We are introducing legislation in hopes of putting into ORS Chapter 246 the ability for our office to conduct elections in a county that may be facing a fiscal crisis in which the governor has proclaimed that currently only county clerks may conduct elections throughout the state. That's provided in Chapter 246 as well, although the secretary does oversee and maintain the uniformity of the elections process throughout the state. We would like to have in statute specifically that we could conduct the elections for a county if needed so.
questions on that specific piece? I think we've had some time to discuss that. Thank you very much.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Mann. I'm with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. We have a very small part to play, but it has big impact for veterans around the state. You're very familiar with your county veteran service officers. We get about $6 million of general fund each biennium, and about 51% of that is passed through to the counties to help fund veteran service offices. In statute, the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs is responsible for providing all services, and it's a great partnership. Our concern, obviously, would be if a county decides not to have a veteran service officer, how would we make sure those veterans in that county were supplied with those people? Currently, 34 counties in the state have veteran service officers. So our contingency planning is what we would want to do is take the money that we give through pass-through to a county and be able to take that back to the agency and then use that same money to provide that service. And that could look a different, couple different ways. We could contract with the current service officer. We could have a county take on a second county to do work. We could have a state veteran service officer deploy, go TDY if it were, to that county. We have a lot of different ways to do this depending on how big the county is and where the county is. However, under current statute, we are not allowed to keep that money. If a county does not participate in the program, or if it were to fold, that money would come back to the agency and be dispersed to the remaining counties. So our little legislative fix on that is simply to say, if a county were to stop having its county veteran service office, the money would return back to the agency, which only then could be used to provide veteran services in that county. And that's how we would probably take a look at doing that. We think it's a pretty easy fix, to be honest with you. We don't have any pushback from the counties that we know of on that concept. And like I said, it's a small little piece, but I think it's an important piece for us to be able to continue to provide all those veterans those services. One last thing you need to know, the military is planning on letting 1 million troops go in the next 5 years. And we'll get back between 30 and 50,000 of them here in Oregon. And so we have a tsunami coming at us. So we are very hopeful we can keep our veteran services as robust as possible.
Senator.
The only thing you left out of your very animated testimony, Mr. Mann, is the fact that these veteran service officers have a track record of returning an extraordinary amount of benefit money to the state. I think it's shocking that we make veterans beg for the benefits that they were promised and they earned, but in your calculation, keeping those veteran service officers' functions in place yields real monetary benefit, not only to the veteran, but to the state.
Correct. Currently, it's a $6 million general fund investment for a $1.9 billion annual return of federal benefits.
Thank you, Senator. That's a good point. Tom, can I ask, is the idea or could the idea include, because it seems to me also from the folks that I know that perform the service of county service veterans officers, they also tend to have a lot of relationships built with veterans. I mean, they know the veterans, they get to know them quite well, they become quite intimate in the things that they're advocating for in terms of benefits. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned two or three scenarios in which it might work, but is it fair to say that maybe the number one scenario would be that you'd have the ability to hold the money and that the first option would be that the current county veteran service officer be maintained through that? I mean,
Mr. Coach, that would be our preference. Absolutely.
In the concept, is that a possibility? I mean, then, to say?
I'm not sure I'd want to tie my hands that much because current funding is, depending on the county, sometimes the state gives a lot more and the county gives less. Sometimes, like in larger counties, they give three times as much as the state, so that service officer wouldn't be paid as much, and they may not want to stay for the kind of money they would be contracted to do the job for. And so we would just want a little bit of flexibility to make sure that we could work that out with the person on the ground. Certainly, we would not be providing the full-time service that's currently there. And so, for example, Josephine County, we have a fantastic county veteran service officer who's been there forever. I would love to contract her if her county went down, but I could probably only pay her for a couple, two, maybe 3 days a week, and I don't know if that would help, would sustain her family or not.
Well, so those are the type of things we can talk more about that. Right. Thank you. I mean, I think my point is you got people who have incredible relationships.
Yes.
To prioritize giving them the option because if the option simply is, hey, look, I can only employ you 3 days a week, but keep in mind we're here because we're in a financial crisis. So they may want to stay, but give them the option or first option to stay. If you got to go a different direction, maybe you do.
I think we'd
I just
be good
like
with
the
that.
Idea of that
I think
conversation.
We'd be good with that.
And for any of the veterans organizations that are listening, and certainly Representative McLean, you may have some contacts there that would be beneficial. I'd like to hear from them. I think that might be an idea that we would like to vet out a little bit. So thank you very much. Mark.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Senator Berger. For the record, my name is Mark Lom, the administrator of State Building Codes. I've got a PowerPoint presentation. I'll go through it really quickly, recognizing the time that we have. My hope is just to provide background on an issue that we see coming and then be part of an effort to proactively get in front of the state's ability to help county governments as we move forward. So just quickly, I take the time to let everybody know what we do at Building Codes. We set uniform statewide construction standards. We resolve disputes and appeals. We license subcontractors and trade workers. One of the things you ought to know about our organization, it's unique. It's the one of a kind in the country. The idea of a statewide uniform code means predictability to businesses. No matter where they work, the code standards are the same in Oregon. That's primarily what we spend our time on. What I'm here to talk about today, though, is the service side of what we do. We provide services where local entities choose not to, where the provider of last resort at times, and we think that there's going to be some issues in the forefront as counties struggle and cities struggle with the economic realities where the state may need to provide, have additional flexibility in my office to provide services to those counties so that we maintain economic viability when construction starts coming back up, which we know that it will at some point. So this is just a quick graph on the kind of activities that have occurred in the counties. This is representative of all city and counties who sell building permits. It's just the permit side on the building side. Plan review, you could probably double that, $75 million. In 2007, you could see that number. You can see there was 187,000 permits issued. One of the interesting things of this graph, if you look at 2008, we actually had more building permits than we had revenue, and those things happen as you go through this cyclical nature where folks shift to smaller projects, you lose some of the institutional spending, but the big issue is the revenue has dropped down. And I should let everybody know if you don't know. On the building code side, this is other fund, and it's fees for service. We're not talking about general fund. We're not talking about any of the other types of dollars out here. This is direct fee for service. When contractors purchase a permit, it pays for the inspection. You can also see that over here in 2011, that same situation kind of inversed again, where we had revenue stabilize and then permit activity go down. We think that's some of the impacts of some of the institutional stuff where the revenue stayed the same, but the overall activity in the state caught up to where you see the problems that we have. What does that mean for our counties? If you look at the permit revenue between 07 and 12, I won't go through each of the counties, but over here on the right-hand side, we identify 1 to 40% decline, 40 to 60% decline, 60 to 80% decline. There's over 20 counties that include cities on this map that in the last 5 years have had over a 40% decline in their building permit revenue and are struggling to keep up with services that are needed when contractors need them. So. Okay. Oops.
Did I go one too fast?
Okay, that's the revenue side. Excuse me. Here's the permit count side. Same map, same county layout. This includes cities and counties. We kind of put it together because it's a task force on counties. And again, if you look at these lighter shaded colors, these are the areas where, because of economic conditions and other things, the activity level, 500 permits or less in a year are being issued by these counties. They have great geographic areas to try to cover, to provide these services, not a lot of revenue. We think that that's going to create problems. We've heard from several counties that because of either timber payment issues, other general fund issues, they're subsidizing their building department activities, trying to keep them up and running. But we think that some of this may revert back to the state, or the state need to provide some help to make sure that we provide the same level of service in our rural areas, in these areas that get in the valley area. The last thing is this is a graph that we get from McGraw-Hill. These are the same folks that produce the Dodge Report in construction. Many folks may be familiar with this. This is on value. So this is basically a relationship of the square footage out there and the value of construction. This is not the amount of activity that you see or economic input, but it's reflective of what we've seen over time. And you know, we started off and we doubled a couple times in this area, our big growth up to 2005, and we've dropped off. and the Dodge folks are telling us that we're have flattened out, and I expect this to go back up. I've been doing this for 20 years. Although this has been a pretty difficult economic recession, things will pop back up. We'll get things cleared out. And what I'm asking for is flexibility both on the budget side and hiring side so that, and partnerships with counties, that if there's problems where they need to revert those programs back to the state, we can get up and running so that we don't slow up construction projects or create any difficulty for the business communities out there in these areas that are struggling. And I ratchet through that very quickly because I wanted to respect your time and see if there's any questions that you have.
Questions, finally, for this panel? Thank you very much. I think, Mark, you know, the layman's terms here is if you got a county that ends up in insolvency with no building department and something needs to be built, we still need to have a way to get there, inspect it, make sure we're following proper building codes. And you're saying you need flexibility to be able to fill that gap.
Yes, sir. Mr. Co-Chair, we want to be able to ramp up quickly and take the needs because it's going to come back, and we don't want to be a detriment to the local community at all.
All right. Please.
Mr. Chair, the final component of this concept is dealing with the services provided by the county tax collector.
Mm-hmm.
If a county is unable to provide for tax collection services, it affects the county's flow of revenue just as importantly, but also all of the other local governments in the county depend on that. So right now, while the Department of Revenue has the authority to step in and assume some appraisal functions, there is no explicit authority to assume the tax collection function. So this concept would also add that if a county was failing to meet an minimally adequate level of service, that the Department of Revenue could step in and provide some services there.
Thank you. Well, I thank this panel greatly, and I'm sorry that I began to rush you just a little bit, but okay. We're up against the timeline, and since Co-Chair Roblin got to leave, I got to be the bad guy here, so I do appreciate your timeliness. Thank you so much. While these folks are leaving the dais, I'd like to invite up David Gerstenfeld, I hope I'm close, Unemployment Insurance Administrator from the Oregon Employment Department, and Isabella Jolson, Deputy Administrator from Oregon Employment Department. Welcome. Thank you for being with us. Thank you for your patience and waiting through an entire program to get to this point. But please introduce yourselves and begin.
Co-Chair Hannah, Member of the Committee, my name is Isabella Jolson, Deputy Administrator.
Put the microphone.
Thank you. My name is Isabel Jocelyn, Deputy Administrator for the Unemployment Insurance Tax Program with the Employment Department.
And Co-Chair Hannah, Co-Chair Verger, members of the task force, I'm David Gerstenfeld. I'm the Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance for the Employment Department. Thank you for having us. And our purpose here today is really to make sure that the policy implications of how the unfortunate event of a county not being able to pay its unemployment insurance obligations would play out under the current state of the law. This is something that got a little bit of attention in the media earlier in the year. There was a newspaper article, and the Employment Department distributed a fact sheet to legislative leadership back in June of 2012 about this. But we wanted to make sure that as you're considering the various policy implications about fiscal difficulties in counties, that this is something that was looked at. The unemployment insurance system does address that scenario right now. So unemployment insurance benefits are paid to claimants out of a trust fund. Even if a county was not able to pay its unemployment insurance obligation, the claimants would still receive their benefits. So the question then arises of who's paying for those benefits. The money is coming out of the unemployment insurance trust fund. That trust fund, in turn, is funded by employers, whether they're private or public sector employers. The way that trust fund gets funded, there's a few different mechanisms. In Oregon, the vast majority of those contributions are made by taxpaying employers. Almost 98% of the employers make their contributions through a payroll tax. Some counties also are directly reimbursing, where they reimburse the trust fund dollar for any benefits that are paid out to its former employees. Ultimately, what method those payments are made doesn't really have much of an impact on the underlying dilemma of benefit payments going out and a county's contribution for that potentially not coming in. What would happen under current law is it could impact the tax rate that the tax-paying employers do pay. Oregon has a very strong unemployment insurance trust fund. the statutory scheme that's been put into place has it as a self-balancing fund. So as the trust fund balance goes down, we move up a series of tax schedules to higher tax rates. And then as the balance in that fund goes up, tax schedules go down and employer tax rates go down. So the possible implication here is that if a county or any employer is not putting in money that's being paid out in benefits, the trust fund balance will drop, and at some point that can result in the taxpaying employers, all of the taxpaying employers, having a higher tax rate than they otherwise would. We do have some more recent projections than we did back in June when we did the general fact sheet. Oregon right now is in the highest tax schedule, Schedule 8. We're projected to remain in that tax schedule all of this year and next year. Current projections appear to have us dropping from Schedule 8 to Schedule 6 in calendar year 2014, but it's by a relatively slim margin of about $26 million. So if the trust fund were to be short $26 million from our current projections, instead of dropping two levels to tax Schedule 6, we would only drop to tax Schedule 7. The implications of that would mean that the difference between those two tax schedules for tax-paying employers across the state is that they would pay an additional approximately $46 million in payroll taxes that year. So it essentially gets spread out among all of the tax-paying employers. From our projections, no single county, even if it failed to make any payments and had a very disastrous situation, would make the difference between us dropping to Schedule 7 or Schedule 6 in 2014. But if multiple counties had very serious fiscal situations and couldn't pay all of their obligations, it could have that impact.
David, can I interrupt you for a minute? Can you help us understand a scenario in which a county that was a reimbursing county, not a taxpaying county, but a reimbursing county, under what scenario would a county that's a reimbursing county not make their payment?
Coach Rahan, it's essentially the same as whether they're taxpaying or not. We, as I said, we pay the benefits out to the claimant. We then essentially bill the employer. It's either a direct bill to a reimbursing employer of we paid your former employees X dollars, you owe us X dollars, or it's more of a delayed billing essentially through a tax rate. We would pay benefits to the claimant. We would then bill the county and say you owe us this much in reimbursements. The scenario, for instance, that was in the newspaper earlier in the year was a county that said at some point they may be faced with a dilemma of pay this bill from the employment department or keep a jail open, keep law enforcement on the road, and they would make that decision and conceivably could decide, could either decide not to pay our bill or might not have the funds to do it.
Well, and maybe I'm simplifying this too much. I don't know. I'm an employer, so I'm trying to get the math in my head. You know, insolvency to a county doesn't mean their income goes away because they still have their property tax collections and whatever other funds are still coming. So insolvency to a business might mean all their revenue is gone, so they don't have anything to pay. But if you just use the scenario that the reason you are reimbursing an unemployed employee, former employee, is because they're no longer working for the county. So now the county has the money they weren't paying in payroll to pay the unemployment benefit. And I'm...
The money may be there. And part of this goes to what one of the issues in this situation that we're addressing. The employment department can go after any employer that doesn't pay its obligation, whether it's a reimbursement or a tax, the same way. Mm-hmm. We need to show that they owe the money, that they didn't pay it, and we then essentially can get a judgment against them. Normally, we can use the judicial collection methods then to force them to pay us, mm-hmm, if they have assets. We cannot do that with counties.
So time out for me just for a moment, and that's what I'm playing out here. So the same method used to get reimbursement, i.e. attachment of a bank account or other assets in an individual business, for whatever reason of law, you, the department, don't have that same ability with all public entities or only counties?
All public entities.
Can you describe that just a little bit for us?
Certainly. There's a set of statutes that sets out what types of property are not subject to execution, to garnishment, attachment, and
that statute, ORS 18.345, and Section 1G says that one type of property that is not subject to execution is property of the state, county, cities, municipalities. So we could get essentially a judgment against a governmental entity that didn't pay its bill, but we wouldn't have the ability to go out and forcibly collect that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Farioli.
If you had the same situation with a private sector obligor, wouldn't it be the county sheriff that would do the attachments?
Co-chair, Hannah, Senator Farioli, yes. If you're doing an attachment of personal property, it would be for garnishments of bank accounts or some other types. It's not.
And, Mr. Chairman, I would suggest to you that the county sheriff would be unlikely to attach the county's property for tax payments or obligations.
Thank you, Senator. And I think the problem we're all trying to vet out here is that literally you could have a county who is a employer, have people on unemployment for which the agency paid the benefit, and the obligation to pay the benefit back could be ignored.
Correct, Co-Chair Hannah. We would not be able to forcibly collect that. And that is the issue that we wanted to raise here, because that then would impact potentially the tax rate, depending on the scope of that unpaid obligation.
Either the tax rate, if you could go higher, which at the time were at the highest, or the length at which it stayed at the upper rate or didn't move down.
Correct.
Basically, the burden gets spread to everybody else. And yeah.
Correct, okay. Co-Chair Hannah.
Yep. Thank you very much.
Mr. Co-Chair, question.
Senator Farioli.
It's a tangential question. It's not exactly on the topic, but as the co-chair pointed out, every Oregon employer would stay longer in a higher bracket if these counties serially default on their obligation. So more than one is what I heard you say. A couple, yep. Two, three could be a problem. Tangential question. Are state agencies self-insured for unemployment?
Co-Chair Roland, Senator Farioli, state agencies, the state as an employer, is a reimbursing employer, so okay. Essentially self-insured.
Okay. If the state agencies were paying into the unemployment fund, what effect would that have on all of the participants in the fund?
I don't have a dollar answer to give you right now. We can run some scenarios on that.
Would you please?
I would, and I may need to follow up. The short answer is it depends on what stage of kind of the cycle of rebuilding the trust fund or depleting the trust fund we're at. Right now, when we're in the highest schedule, the goal is to have enough money coming in to pay all current claims and build up the reserve for a future recession. So the impact of having the state as an employer be a taxpaying employer is different than if we hadn't had a recession in decades and the trust fund was well in excess of our projected needs. But I'm happy to follow up with you and get you some projections.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, I think I may be obligated to explain the point of the question. As a reimbursing entity, the state only has an obligation after the fact, but many other employees are paying their portion as they go.
Yeah.
And it could be argued that we outsmarted ourselves by sort of self-allowing state agencies to be self-insuring, not carrying the cost of unemployment on the books on a daily basis. I think it would have the effect of lowering the cost for all payors, but I'd like to see your research on that question. Thank you, Mr. Chairs.
Thank you. Other questions? I see none. So we must be done. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it. We are very close to the meeting our time, which was really nice, so thank you for that. I do want to say to all the presenters, I really do appreciate the fact you came not only with an explanation of where you were, but solutions. And I think if there was one common solution we heard today, it was the use of our natural resources in appropriate ways, and figuring out how to get that to happen is a goal that we all have.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Sawlogs.
Sawlogs.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I like the sand that I'm selling. I like, there's other kinds of things that are natural resources.
Water from water. Columbia, Mr. Chair.
You
thank you.
So, with that, I thank everybody for being here, and we will adjourn our
task force.
Joint task force on county payments.